So we had a question, and here, go ahead.
Thank you. Pavlos Georgilakis from NTUA. First of all, congratulations to all authors for their very interesting presentations and very important contributions. I have a remark for the second paper. I am very pleased to see the presentation of Christos Nakos. In fact, how they managed to use a tool in a very effective way. What I mean, the Center for Renewable Energy Sources, as Christos presented, use TIMES model, or previously known TIMES Markal model, which is a macroeconomic model, which is dedicated to very long-term planning, like let's say 30-year or 40-year planning, of combined generation and transmission expansion planning in multiple stages, let's say 40 years in a 5-year step. So they adapted this model in order to capture phenomena related with renewable energy sources. As everybody here knows, one model is never perfect, and I think that very nicely Christos mentioned that this model has one shortcoming, the fact that it doesn't take into account the network. So it makes the expansions without taking into account the network. Just to mention here, and this is my remark, that this problem is in fact, let's say, almost alleviated through a project financed by the European Union, where CRES, in collaboration with NTUA and other partners, let's say, solve the problem. We are now at the final phase of validating the model, and this model will be used in, as happens today for TIMES model, in a country level, in a city, in a region level, in Europe and worldwide, as we know, and for making energy policy decisions. Thank you very much, and once again, congratulations to all of you.
This is just a comment that they
just
gave.
Okay.
So there was somebody else on this side. I think Tassos.
Tassos Bakirtsis, Aristotle University of Thessaloniki. I also have a question. I have a question for Christos. Mentioned that you use pumping to in relation with renewable energy generation. The studies we have made in our laboratory, we noticed that it is very unlikely to spill wind energy if you plan 10 days ahead. As I noticed from your presentation, your scheduling period is 10 days. So what you give your scheduling algorithm is a 10-day wind forecast. So if you have a 10-day wind forecast, then during your unit commitment, you commit less units according to your wind forecast, so the likelihood to spill wind is very low. Wind spillage will happen because of wind forecast errors, which I don't believe you model in your simulations here. This is one comment, and the other comment, this is one question, or comment, whatever, and the other question is, how do you schedule your water releases in your 10-year periods, in your 10-day periods, sorry. And last question, why 10 days and not 2 weeks, so that you capture a full weekly, two full weekly cycles in your simulation?
Christos Nakos from CRES. I will take the reverse way. 10 day, it's just 10 day. Not for experiencing in a 2 week scheduling period, I saw that the computational time was much more increasing. So I stayed at 10 days, which is more or less an exception, an empirical accepted time frame. The scheduling of the hydro is coming from another model. So I give the scheduling from another model. I don't make any kind of... I give the energy coming from another model, and the allocation of the energy of the hydro is happening in a 10-day scheduling period. Now, the case of pumping is a little bit difficult. I had to, if I understand well, what I would try to represent here is that the fact that the pumping is the key. Pumping. I try to combine it with the rejected energy. So any time the model, the optimization sees that it will have rejected energy from wind, let's say, then it pays a penalty. And whenever this price is very high, then it activates the pumping load. In the final run, it cannot be made because I have the constraint for unserved, load. So I take the sum of consumption load and pumping load, and the model has to serve it. Yeah, that's why I'm using the pre-runs, where I don't have this unserved constraint, unserved load constraint, and I'm trying to make, this is, I'm experiencing in having a load, an offer, a load which is very of low price, so the pumping load is very low, let's say 3 euro per megawatt hour, so no generation unit will find an incentive to serve it. And because of that, but the model can see possible amounts of rejected energy, so it activates the pumping load in order not to have rejected energy. That's the mechanism I use. If I understand well your question, you say you said that there's going to be no, in a 10-day period, there are going to be no wind spillover, which I said, risk containment, if we speak the same language, right? There will be no risk containment because of the perfect foresight, or yeah, but there's the possibility, the technical constraints, to activate the penalty cost. So the model, because the rejected energy, is the last in the hierarchy of penalty costs. So whenever another constraint is going to be to activate the technical constraint to violate it, then it chooses to reject energy. So that's. That maybe is an answer, or if I don't understand well your question. Thank you.
I will continue on my question. What my point was is that once you have perfect foresight, there is only a slight possibility to have rejected energy. Have you the or you will underestimate your rejected wind energy by much. I think the correct way to do it is model both the real-time operation of the power system and model the error of the day ahead or whatever wind forecast according to which you will perform your scheduling, your unit commitment relative to what this is an ongoing research in our laboratory in the framework of a state funded project. Alex is also our external advisor in this project, and we are trying to model both the short term and the day ahead, the hour by hour and the day ahead operation of the power system to capture the wind spillage in a more realistic way.
In this sense, I agree, I underestimate the rejected energy.
Okay, Marianne had a question in the back.
Yeah, because I already have the microphone. If I
well, I think basically then you have the floor. What can I say?
exactly. Rachid Cherkaoui, Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne. My question is for Joao concerning the restoration. Did you account for the computation time consideration while using this restoration process? Because I guess that your methodology is designed for real-time restoration. So can you elaborate on this, give us some information? Thank you.
Okay, so João Passos Lopes, Inesco Porto, Portugal. Well, yes, I agree with you. We have not been concerned with the time simulation. We were just trying to identify the way how the wind farms can contribute for the system restoration. This is not a tool to help system operators to do the system restoration. This is more a research in terms of identification of the problems that we may have to face and the way how to cope with them. So we are only at the first stages. But however, we feel that it is important to optimize, and that this optimization is in somehow also related with the need to identify procedures that we could pass to the dispatching operators to help them in this restoration approach. Okay, I don't know if I have answered.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you. Marian Angelo Salamos, I have a comment and a question for the first paper. Very nice work, congratulations, and congratulations for that matter to all of you. It seems to me that the confidence levels are chosen by the users, which is fine, but they are in some sense a measure of risk, and there is a cost associated to risk. So in this regard, it seems more natural to me to enhance your cost function and to add a weighted risk of cost to that function and transform these alpha parameters, confidence levels, into decision variables. And then when you minimize this enhanced cost, I suspect you'll get in your expansion cost versus confidence level, you'll find a minimum, which of course depends on how the user selects to balance the expansion cost versus the cost of risk. So I wonder if this is a sensible approach, and how difficult will it be to modify your algorithm to include this confidence level as decision variables in your algorithm.
Thanks for the question. This is Monisha from University of Calgary. If I understood your question correctly, you mean like addressing the objective function as a probabilistic measure and having that alpha as also a decision variable. It can be done. It will complicate the problem. And in this case, we are more concerned of having in the case of my simulation results, you can have for any confidence level. The simulation can be run for any confidence level, and you can have a corresponding answers for that. But of course, if it is a decision variable, and you will know the corresponding cost, that is much better solution. It can be done, and we will explore that further. Yeah.
Thank you, George. I have two comments.
Yeah. You have to still state your name.
Okay.
Even if you're a Greek citizen.
Okay, thank you. Alex Papalexopoulos, ECHO International. I have two comments on the second paper and a question for the first paper. First of all, I fully agree with Tasos. Tasos' comments are very important for this paper. The second comment is, you don't include transmission in your analysis, which also was referred by the first comment. Based on our experience, especially when you do studies for unserved energy and also for curtailment of renewables, you need to include transmission. We have seen that with the penetration of renewables, if you don't include transmission, you lose many events. We have seen that in many systems, not only just one or two from our studies. So, and also to make decisions about curtailment, physical curtailment. Of course, contractual curtailment is another issue if you're allowed to do this, but for physical curtailment, you got to include transmission. That's the comment. Now, the question about the first paper, I really enjoy your paper. I especially agree with your approach to include slack variables in the bus level and get visibility in the bus level about issues about load shedding or what you call stressed buses. We fully support this approach in order to get visibility in the bus level. You didn't have the chance to talk about the coefficient that goes with the slack variable, which is very important. Usually for that coefficient, that penalty that you put in the objective could vary, because basically this is the loss of load value, could be depending on studies from 3,000 to 40,000 or depends. So the question is, have you done any analysis for your system with your method in playing with that penalty, especially in relationship with penalties for other controls or constraints in your OPF formulation? I assume you use penalties for other constraints as well. This ties to constraint relaxation policy you have. For example, for transmission lines, the relative value of that penalty with respect to other penalties can change your results a lot. I'm not sure if you have any insights about this. Do you care to comment on that?
First of all, I have only one penalty function, which is added only to the supply. This is Monisha from University of Calgary. The penalty is added only once for the supply-demand constraint. I don't have any other penalties in my formulation. And of course, we have not considered other constraints for the penalty, because we are mainly saying that only generation adequacy is a problem, and so we don't have it on the transmission lines. With respect to the cost that we have chosen for the penalty, we tried different values, like it was mostly on a trial and error basis. The only thing that we were concerned was the penalty should not appear for any feasible cases, the first thing, and it should appear only when there is no other alternative. These two were made sure, and the least, like when we tried different set of values, the least one that was able to give the results were chosen. So there is no other two different penalties for me to compare.
So you don't enforce transmission constraints in your formulation?
I have transmission line constraints. Yes, I have like minimum maximum capacity constraints, but I don't relax that constraint with the slack variables.
I see, okay. Louis Behenkel had a question.
Okay.
Sandro, yeah, you have to mark.
Sandro Corsi from Italy. I have two questions to Damir. Okay. You introduced your system as a synchrophasor system, but looking at your presentation and the picture and so on, it appears like a complete SCADA EMS system. Now I wonder, how flexible is your system to interface the existing SCADA EMS system in a way to add, to introduce the functionality related to the PMUs and so on? This is the first question.
Should I answer first?
You prefer to answer?
Yeah, let me answer first and then we go to the second. Thanks, Sandro. And by the way, I really want to acknowledge Sandro for providing his work, and was really helpful in us moving forward with the work that we have done. So thank you, Sandro. The key issue really here is how many PMU measurements you really have. And in some cases, as we you saw that slide when I'm showing how we are going to, from conservative to aggressive, we are adding more and more PMU measurements. So the bottom line is that you can use this system either with SCADA measurements or with the PMU measurements. But of course, and that's the whole point, that with SCADA measurements, you're going to miss some of the major contingency events, and you will not be able then to do the calculation in the time that you need to do the calculation at. So the bottom line is you can use both, but of course it's preferable to use the synchrophasor data.
Okay.
Am I answering the question?
Yeah. The second question is related to my understanding. I could be wrong about the way the computation is performed. It appears like a fully centralized system, in one end. But in second, you also said that you can also use directly the PMU measurement for some functionality, for some indicator. So my question is, is your system also able to allow a decentralized control in case it's possible to use directly the PMU measurement for some functionalities.
Yes, and it comes back to that stepwise process of being using the phasor measurement system for various functions. We are, for example, using now a distributed method for fault location calculation. So you can actually use it in between two substations. You can use the phasor measurement system very distributed. And then you have a application like EMS application where, and state estimation when you're using the centralized approach. So it's actually how the project was structured was that GE would have applications in the substation and Alstom would have application in the central control room. And the reason was because PG&E is using Alstom tools and they don't really like to change the tools. So the key was to, and I did mention that actually during the call, during the presentation, that it was so important to actually exchange the data with the neighbors. And you really want to have a system that you are comfortable with and then build on top of it. So to add to this point that we are going on the distributed level to the substations, then we go to the central control room, but we also go to the wide area system. And actually it's my key point here is, we call it wide area monitoring, protection, and control. And at the same time, it's sometimes very difficult to share data. I'm sure there are issues with ENTSO-E here in Europe with this, but it really defies the purpose. If you really want to use this technology, you should be able to find a way. And I know there are legal issues and lawyers get involved, guys. You don't want to hear these stories, but it's not a simple issue. But at the same time, if you want to benefit, if there is an event in the system, you really want to have operators in Belgium and operators in Greece to see the similar thing. And you don't really need to have exactly the same tool. You don't have to have one vendor to do it. But if you have standards, if you have a way to represent the visualization, then you can actually resolve this. So to answer your question, there is actually this system should cover from distributed to the wide area, like Western interconnection system, sharing data across the Western interconnection. Thanks.
Could you get behind to our friend Louis?
Thank you, Louis Wienkel from University of Liège. I had a couple of questions for the first paper, and the first one are some clarifications to make sure that I understand correctly. So the load model, I mean the uncertainties in the load model for your problem is it's a Gaussian model, but I wanted to know whether you, at the different buses, you consider independent load variations, totally independent or totally correlated ones, so just to clarify. And the second question, your method is basically in a narrative fashion replacing this chance constraint by some deterministic constraints, trying to find the right, let's say, overestimation of the demand at each bus such that you reach this alpha level of confidence. And I wanted to know, and at each iteration you solve like 1,000 OPF of the network, so I wanted to know how fast this converges. So that were the clarification points. So in the examples, how many iterations you need to do that. And more on the method, you compare your method with the standard uniform z-update algorithm and you find that you get a better solution, but you cannot claim that your solution is really the best solution satisfying the chance constraint. So do you have any idea how far you are from a really optimal solution of your original chance constraint problem? Thank you.
This is Monisha from University of Calgary. For the first question, yes, we have considered 100% correlation. So that's how the simulation results are for. In terms of the iterations, for any system, for any confidence level, I'll require at least 3 minimum iterations because I choose 2 starting points, a lower and a higher, and then at least I need 1 more to reach to my target. So the minimum will be 3 iterations. And after that, it depends on the random samples generated. On an average, for all my simulations, it was like around average is 5 iterations, but I have never crossed more than 7. I'm not sure about your third question. If it was like, if it was correct, do you ask like, is this a global optimum? Is that your question?
Yes.
Yes. Like, as you can see, the problem is non-convex because I'm assuming normal distribution, so it is a non-convex. The z is a non-convex assumption. I don't have any closed form solution to prove that it is a global optimum, but we tried for various starting points, like the initial two starting points. We tried for number of starting points, and in terms of the solution. Of course, there will be a difference in the cost because it is just not the investment cost but also the operation cost. So the amount of power it dispatches might vary. But in terms of the number of new units installed, that was the same for any starting point. In terms of that, like, that is the major outcome of the expansion problem. I need to know how many new units I need. So that number of new units were same irrespective of the starting point. But the power it dispatched might differ, and hence there will be a difference in the cost. So if you can compare the investment cost, yes, it will be the same. So I don't have a closed form solution to say that it is a global optimum, but we verified it for a different starting points, and we got the same results.
So my sub-question then is, if you say that it's relatively robust in terms of where you put the new generation, is there any difference between the modified algorithm and the original one in this respect?
It's not the same in terms of where the generation is, but it is the same in terms of the number of new units. That's the difference. I'm able to identify the stress buses, and so I can say those are the potential places for new installation. And I'm also able to say the number of new units. The difference is in the, I'm able to identify the areas of installation. That is the main difference between the modified and the older method.
Okay, let's go from Louis to Luis.
Thank you. My name is Luis Vargas from University of Chile. This is a question for the third paper, Joao. The first is related to other possible technologies that also use power converters. For example, let's say a solar concentrator PV. The question is that, do you foresee a similar application, or if you see any differences in or problems with the, for example, solar technologies as compared to wind power, the one that you just showed? And the second question is related to a comment you just said, I believe. You said that this may lead to new PSR procedures, and I would like, you mentioned that this could lead also to possible faster restoration times. Could you make comments on that as well? Thank you.
Okay, so regarding so solar PV or even some large storage devices that are interfaced with the grid via electronic grid interfaces, I think that it is possible to have them participating in these preliminary stages of the power system restoration, either by providing reactive power support, as well as active power in terms of participating in frequency correlation. However, in this case, for instance, for the case of PV solar, this is a little bit more complex because, of course, you can also deload. I mean, to bring the PV panels away from the maximum power extraction curve, and so operate in a similar manner. The problem is that if you have a day where solar resources are changing too fast, this will be more difficult. And in this case, what we foresee is to have on the DC link a storage device, and that storage device will be such that will be capable to serve as a buffer, and in this case to support in some way the contributions, the fast contributions for frequency regulation. So that's the way how we see it. Okay, regarding your second question, we believe that it is possible to have these units contributing for a faster power system restoration, because, for instance, if we have very large converters, like the case of offshore wind farms, they are such that they can participate in the control of voltage, which is one of the critical issues in all the power system restoration. So to absorb the surplus of reactive power that exists during the first stages where lines are not enough loaded. And so if we are capable to energize the lines that go up to these generation facilities and to connect these converters, I think that they will support the first stages in terms of the contribution for the voltage regulation, and this is because this is one of the critical stages in all the power system restoration approach. And so I do believe, but as I said, this is very much dependent on the system structure, on the mix of the generation, on the topology and on everything. So we have to test it. But I believe that this is possible, okay?
Thank you. Canizares has been waiting in there for quite some time, so I think you have enough storage now to answer some questions.
Thanks, George. Hey, first, let me start by congratulating Damir for his presentation. I found it very entertaining, certainly, but very interesting as well. It's nice to see the industry perspective in all of this, these type of developments and applications, and it'd be great if people like yourself, forward-looking industry people, participate more in these meetings, and look forward to having you participate in the VANF conference. Now, moving forward to my question to Joao. Very interesting to see how you are evolving these applications of VSI technologies, right? You're going, starting with voltage control, then we move on to frequency control, and now you're proposing restoration applications of it. Congratulate you for that. If I understood correctly, basically this is based on an app, basically on the HVDC link, HVDC light link that you're using basically for frequency regulation, right? Now, as you move to DFIG, in DFIG, that's now you have more distributed resources, right? You don't have this common link. So how do you see these other type of resources participating on this, as you sort of mentioned that? And in that context, in the case of Portugal, how much DFIG versus these HVDC light link technologies are available for you to do this type of applications? Thanks.
Well, in Portugal, we don't have offshore wind farms for the moment. But we will see for the future. So what we have presently is large wind farms, very large wind farms, for instance, 200 megawatts wind farms. And so in this case, we also foresee the possibility of having them participating in these restoration procedures. However, the problem is not all of them have this kind of capabilities. It is important, for instance, that they will be capable to behave like STATCOMs for voltage control purposes. It is important that they will be capable to provide primary frequency control contribution. And this is, in fact, not fully available in all the wind energy converters. In Portugal, we have launched a few years ago a tender for wind generation installation, and we have asked for this kind of capabilities. So this means that presently 1,500 megawatts of the 4,500 megawatts that we have installed in Portugal already have these capabilities, but the others don't. So for the others, I don't see this to happen so easily. But for the other ones, yes. So it is feasible. And if we also think that some of the wind farms will have to be replaced after some time because the wind generators will end their lives, and therefore we will have a retrofit of the, some of the units, then it is important to require those capabilities, those for these units to start participating in the provision of this type of ancillary services.
Thanks for the answer. A follow-up question with, regarding this. As you increase these capabilities, yes, very quick, is you increase the cost also of the converters, the bigger capacitors, bigger converters. Do you foresee that as you add these additional capabilities, would you foresee additional costs involved in this?
Yes, there are some additional costs. The cost is mainly the cost of the converter, of course, and also some of the controls. And but this is not the case for power system restoration. This is for the case of the, if you require these wind generation facilities to be for a long time participating in primary frequency control. And then it's not only the price of the converter, it's also the amount of money that the wind park developers will lose just because they will be operating lower. This is very simple. You tell them either you reduce 10% and you are capable to provide primary frequency control, or you are disconnected from the grid, and they will prefer the first one. I can assure you that.
Okay. Incentives do work. We have one last question over here, and then we can break.
Thanks, George, for permitting me the last question. It is just actually not a question. It is a remark. My name is Blanas Giannis from Hellenic System Operator. ADME, as we call it in Greek, in this. My comment is for the last speaker. I enjoyed the presentation, but what I want to emphasize and to request, actually, is that the system operation becomes very complex. We all know this. And it is very important to develop smarter and more advanced visualization tools in order to help operators to identify very fast and where is the problem. I have seen the products from the three big vendors, I don't want to name this, but I was disappointed. They are good to confuse operators in a difficult situation. So my request is to academic community and all those involved that it is a serious and there is a lot of room for improvement. Another point I want to say to you is that all these awareness functions are very important, but I want to inform you that regarding ENTSO-E, they have installed the centralized system. It is now in the integration phase, and some TSOs are already connected to this, but it is very lower than our expectations. It is just the information for the frequency, just to identify that if there is an high landing in Europe and some flows. So we need smarter and more expert tools to help. Thanks.
If you come to the next IRAP meeting, we will have a session on smart confusion systems.
I will try.
I'd like to thank all the speakers. Thank you very much.